So I'm going to pick up from where Rania left off. And I don't know if she's going to be able to join me, but she had to go and take care of one of our colleagues who's not feeling well. So, and if there are any repetitions, as I said, please forgive me. I actually usually do not speak straight. I have slides. These slides are going to be, we're going to, you know, post them so you'll get a chance to see them. But I don't know how much I'm going to stick to the slides. And I know we have the traditional format of having 45 minutes for the presenter to present, and then we have questions. But I would actually like to do this as a conversation and as a dialogue. So at some points, I'm going to go through the points because we've had some discussion already. But at other points, I may pose questions to you, or you pose questions to me. Okay, so this is a dialogue. The slides will be there for you to look at later. So I'd like to do this. So don't worry about interrupting me. It is not interruption. It is a conversation that we're having. Okay, so please jump in either for clarifying questions or for substantive comments or disagreements and whatever. Okay. All right. So basic theoretical concerns of gender aware. And in parentheses, I put feminist and heterodox economics. Now, most of us know that the dominant paradigm in economics has been neoclassical economics, what we call neoclassical economics. Unless we have some exceptional history, we are generally taught that that is the only way to think. And in fact, it's very common to hear things like in textbooks, if you open them, we are sort of going to learn how economists think. And texts always go on as there's one way for economists to think, and this is how economics training and also brainwashing sort of begins. And again, a lot of people will have a lot of questions about this, but usually the way they are confronted with this knowledge and the idea that economists, this is how economists think, is such that they sort of tend to think, well, I don't feel comfortable about this. Something doesn't sit well, but the problem must be with me. I must not be understanding really well. So this is what I have to understand. And then, you know, suffer and stand still and get through the day, get through your exam, da 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 da. And then before we know it, we all get socialized into thinking in a very, very narrow-minded way. The blinders have been successfully installed on our head, and many of us just simply continue to do that. It is sort of the encounters that we have with people who actually think differently. There are always sort of some people that we meet make a difference for us. If we are fortunate enough to meet such persons, then we try to get these blinders off and try to do everything that we can to get the blinders off. So that kind of is the condition of economic training in the world. And this training, this kind of paradigm, of course, is a paradigm that really comes from North America and Europe, and particularly it's the Anglo-Saxon sort of traditions of thinking. But I'd like to say that even when we look at the history of thought of economics in just the Anglo-Saxon ways of thinking, this is not what was always thought or taught. So we have to remember Adam Smith. Who is he? Who is Adam Smith? I know. I am not asking a moronic question, but I'm just searching for a kind of particular description of Adam Smith. I know. You all know who Adam. What's that? He's the invisible hand. Yes. The what? The Wealth of Nations. What year? 1776. Founder of classical economics.
Father. Padre! That's what I was like, what I wanted. Yay, you're going to get the prize today. It says, I'm looking for the word father of economics. Padre, notice there are never any madres. There are only padres in this. Okay, so that's it. And I'm making a profound, actually, I am making a methodological, epistemological. There are no fathers, there are only mothers, there are only fathers. So economics is a motherless child. She's the only motherless child in the world, you know. Is there always, you know, some mother. We actually know people's mothers much better than the fathers. With this new technology, it might be a little bit confusing, but we generally know the mother, but not necessarily the father of children. But economics is an exception. It's a motherless child. Okay, so there comes and the father is. You know, the father of modern economics, economic theory, is supposed to be Adam Smith. And actually, unfortunately, we always think about Adam Smith in relationship to the wealth of nations, from which comes the idea of this invisible hand and the idea that if people are acting in their self-interest, that's where the basis for people who argue that, you know, individuals act as... you know, homo economicus, and they will base it in Adam Smith and in the wealth of nations. Well, Adam Smith had another very important book. It's called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and he talked about virtues, morality, and for some reason, this is the book that is not referred to. So, when we look at the Anglo-Saxon tradition, we actually see that this tradition itself evolved over time. But even if we look at somebody like Adam Smith, we see that the way that he became canonized in economic theory is by appealing to certain selective references to what people could find in the wealth of nations that actually fit their own thinking, ignoring all the richness of Adam Smith and his social thinking, philosophy, and so on. So I am giving this example because I actually, there's a part of me that absolutely loves Adam Smith. Of course, he's associated with the labor theory of value. But in modern renditions, labor theory of value of Adam Smith is totally forgotten. The theory of moral sentiments is forgotten. And for me, as I'm also a trade economist, Adam Smith had a theory of absolute advantage when it came to international trade. And if we read also his texts on international trade, we will see that they are incredibly rich. And actually, I am one of those handful of people who actually think that trade takes place on the basis of absolute advantage and not comparative advantage. So even readings of Smith have been very, very selective and biased to construct this, in order to construct this notion of the rational human economic actor, homo economicus. Now, so I am going to do a little bit refer back to history of thought, classical political economy, Marxian economics, and link those to a little bit to post-Keynesian. I am not going to talk too much about post-Keynesian or Keynes, but I want to actually go back and do this exercise of remembering the father. And also, I'm going to talk or refer very and say emphatically that there are also many, many mothers of economics, and this would in itself would be a separate sort of lecture. But I just want us to remember that there are mothers also in economics. However, women in general have not been a central part of the process of production of economic knowledge because they have been excluded. Neither have very large or representatives of very large groups of men in the world. So economics has been constructed by
men who come from fairly similar backgrounds and also come from fairly similar cultural backgrounds as well. It will be hard to for anyone to remember if I ask you, who is there a father of economics, someone who can we can think about as father of economics who comes from, let's say, Asia? Amen. I'm not even talking about that. Comes from Asia, comes from Latin America, you know, comparable to Smith or Ricardo or Marx. Or if I ask you somebody comparable who comes from Africa and so on, you probably... Yes, but Amartya Sen is a baby compared to the this. You know, this is like this. We're talking about like guys in the several couple of centuries earlier. But you don't know. You probably can't remember. But one of the greatest thinkers of all times was an Arab man named... I don't have the slide. I got to put it. Okay, here comes the next prize. A social thinker, sociologist. Sometimes he's even said to be the father of sociology, although this is generally attributed to Durkheim, for example. No? I'm having so much fun. I am having so much fun. We're not going to go to lunch. We're going to continue this. Yeah. No, we're talking about... I'm now talking about sort of really, really many centuries ago. Well, of course, there is something called Gandhian economics, true, but much prior to Gandhi. Much, Ibn Khaldun. Now, we have a friend from Palestine, yes, Mira, and she will do the correct pronunciation for us.
Ibn Khaldun.
And he is known as the writer of a book called...
Oh, I don't know that I'm in English, but it's like...
where say it in Arabic?
مقدمة ابن خلدون, which is, was an introduction about the human beings and the behaviors and cultures of all, like, according to his observation and that his travels around the world.
And his travels around the world and how societies change or stuck together, and how they changed, what it is that they, that brought change in history, or what made one society different from another, and what century are we talking about?
Oh, I don't know, but it was in the Khulafa Rashidin. It was like, we can say 200 years ago or something.
No, we're talking about 14. So this was a long time ago, and he is known to... he's sometimes acknowledged by people to be the father of sociology, but of course this is a social thought, and we could also say that he had many important things to say also about what we would call economics today. So the problem is that there have been many people who have written, done valuable work and incredible work and so on, but they are sometimes some of them are buried in history, and others have been plain right, other groups of people have plain right been excluded from construction of knowledge, and that's one of the things that also Rania talked about. Now, I haven't even made headway beyond my first slide because I want to talk about gender aware versus feminist and heterodox, what those concepts mean. So I'm going to ask people, what comes to your mind when you see the word heterodox? Because these are words that don't necessarily carry the same meaning. People may not be familiar with them or may have different understandings of them. So let me start with the word heterodox.
Yes, Sylvia.
It's just from, you know, like just cutting that hetero, and then if we look at hetero as like both male and sex, economics, I imagine. Simple literally translation.
Yes, it is the opposite of orthodox. So we can also call neoclassical economics orthodox economics. It is part of the orthodoxy, what we are all taught. And heterodox, economics, but we understand by this really is different varieties of paradigms that are not orthodox, but are encompassing and are embracing a variety of different traditions. Okay, because we are doing it, but thank you very much, because we're doing it as a kind of dialogue, we will probably take the whole time. Okay, all right. So, today when we talk about heterodox economics, and there are many debates about this, but generally we will be talking about people who are not only united by their opposition to neoclassical and orthodox economics, but actually have their own starting points, have their own pre-analytical vision, which shares a kind of a commonality. I'm going to put that out in the next couple of slides. But basically, heterodox economists consist of people who are post-Keynesians, people who are Serafians, people who are, you know, institutionalists, and also feminists. I will include feminists among the heterodox paradigms and schools of thought. Is it clear? And the purpose of my remarks, first of all, is to argue that feminist economics, or if you want to call it gender-aware economics, belongs in this umbrella or of heterodox paradigms of economics, and in that sense is sharply differentiated from orthodox economics and neoclassical economics. I'm going to come. And then the other kind of question that I'm going to sort of pose is that okay, a lot of things that feminist economists argue are also argued by other traditions, such as Marxism, post-Keynesianism, Keynesianism, and so forth, Serafians, etc. So why do we need another paradigm or a paradigmic intervention? I wouldn't say it's a complete paradigm yet, but it is an emerging, we can certainly call it an emerging paradigm. And why do we need another one? Feminist economics shares a lot of things with a bunch of other, with the brothers, I will say. there are still some things that are unique to the feminist visions of the economy, and this is why we have this new sister emerging. And you had your...
Because in feminist economics, in the center of the analysis are women. So it doesn't mean that it just tackled women, it tackled all women and men. But in the center of the analysis are women. And because feminist economics talks about a transformation also and a deconstruction, but with a transformation.
Yes, it is a transformative process of acquiring knowledge. So that we will also talk about. So the feminist economics in general puts people, human beings, but especially those who have been excluded up to now from constructing knowledge into the center of the knowledge. And it puts well-being of humans and children and reproduction, the concept of reproduction of human beings into the center of the knowledge. We're going to sort of say these in a few ways. So there are certain things that are unique about feminist economists who, in terms of what we emphasize and in terms of the kind of what we're trying to do really is really put all these analyses on their head. We are trying to put the world on its head, if you will, and we are trying to do that by putting the analysis and turning it upside down in terms of what we emphasize, what is priority, how we define economics, and who gets to participate in creating knowledge. This is very important. So, because the world is really, the way we look at it, is a very, very it is a very, very unfair place. It's a very unfair place. It's a very unethical place. It's a very immoral place. Everyday life is a really immoral life, except we don't see these immoralities, the immorality of everyday life, because we don't a lot of times stop and pause about what is so immoral, unfair, and unjust in the world. We don't get to always pause enough. Or when we do see them, somebody gives us some kind of justification about, well, what can you do about these poor people? You know, they don't want to work. I'm going to talk about theories of poverty later, but there's basically two types. One is the lazy bum theory of poverty, which says, well, the poor people are poor because they don't want to work. Well, actually, hello, poor people work harder than everybody else. But there is this ideological thing that poor people are poor because they don't want to work. And that means that they are responsible for their poverty, nobody else is. Well, no, this is what I mean by inversion of reality. Inversion of reality. But if we don't look and see and try to probe these things, we are going to, you know, believe, well, poor people, they really don't want to do it. And then what can you do about them if you're a person who is not poor in the traditionally defined sense? Then you say, well, what can we do? There is nothing. This has been with us from time immemorial. I heard this from all kinds of economists, by the way. What can you do about poor people? I have been asked, why do you worry so much about poor people? I worry so much about poor people because of people like you who are economists who think that nothing can be done. So you have to persuade people that it is a condition of violence. It is structural violence. Poverty is structural violence. So you have to turn everything on its head and upside down, and that's what we're trying to do as feminist economists. Yes,
sorry, because you say I can interrupt you.
Absolutely.
Sorry. Well, and I think a good question is to ask to these poor people that these economists think that they are poor, if these people consider themselves poor, because sometimes maybe you arrive at the conclusion that they don't feel in that way, and maybe you have to change this, the way of we consider poverty or poor people, no?
Long discussions of poverty, gender, everything, all of those things. And I just gave poverty as an example of this inversion of reality in terms of people who argue poor people are poor because they don't work. And I would submit as that they actually, poor people work harder and longer hours than other people in life. So, and Rania, you know, when she was talking about processes, that we need to know the process through which different groups of people become poor, I will also give you a very kind of example of these kinds of inversions and not probing into reality. One should probe not only the processes through which different groups of people quote-unquote, become poor or impoverished or their poverty is perpetuated. But one should also ask, as an economist, when one, for example, succeeds in reducing poverty, or let's say the percentage of people who are classified as poor in a society, one should also ask the process through which this was accomplished. Because some things you can accomplish in very perverse ways by doing nothing about them. So if there are a lot of poor people, a lot of poor children, they are malnourished, you do nothing, you don't give them medical care, people with HIV AIDS, you let them die. What have you accomplished? You can accomplish a reduction in the incidence of poverty by doing nothing. Percent of people living in poverty can go down simply because you have let them die. The numbers will look very nice. The numbers look better. So, on the other hand, if you're trying to do something for them and some of them manage to survive as a result of the interventions, you will still have more poor people in the world. Your numbers will look terrible, but you have done the moral thing. You have done the right thing. You have not succeeded maybe completely, but you have done the moral thing. So the moral sentiments, the motivations, the reasons why we do what we do are very, very important. Now, going back to my first slide, the title, where I have the word gender aware, and in parentheses I have the word feminist. I would like to ask a question. The F word is a difficult word to deal with. Now, what does it bring to your mind when you hear the word feminist? Because I know it's a very controversial word. God, I've been in the women's movement for a gazillion years, and especially this was an issue for those of us who were from the South. Sometimes we used the word womanist, even feminist, because they were very sort of also culturally defined definitions of what the word feminist means and so on and so forth. So I'm very well aware, because I've been a part of those struggles of what the word should be. And I just like to get a few ideas about what this means. And Khurshid seems to be one of the designated victims of this course. I am very sorry, but I am just following in Jan's footsteps. I would like to know what the word feminist means to you.
Should I be honest?
Anyway, we are going to be able to tell if you're not honest.
Okay.
I'm on slide one. Okay,
I have been raised in a country where the feminist women's role is not very important. In the Western countries, like softly speaking. So the first thing to which came to my mind when I hear the word feminist is like bringing the woman into power.
That's what it means.
Yeah, like the power. When the Rania was talking about power relations, so right. Like shifting some of the power to women, right. Like in.
Right. And is that good or bad for you, or threatening to you in any way? Is that in any way threatening to you, or do you think?
No, for me personally. No, I'm not afraid saying anything.
That's right. I am sure you have. And in fact, you wouldn't be in this course if you hadn't.
Of course.
Because, you know, who would want to sit through something like this if they are not really sort of wanting to learn about it? Mm-hmm. But honesty is important because it is a very deeply psychologically, can be a very deeply threatening word. The word is threatening. It is sometimes threatening to women as well. This is why I was telling you I would tell you hundreds of stories about the word, the arguments about the word, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to tell, because when I hear the word feminist and how people, gender specialists in my country behave, how they promote this gender awareness, and I feel some kind of offensive thing, that because I don't think that gender equality should be promoted in a way that like moving ahead, the woman only like there should be equal opportunities for all. For example, in Uzbekistan, we have, as I was telling yesterday to some people, we have women working very low-paid job and in very bad conditions. Like, they go in the morning, early in the morning, and they find daily job, and they are ready to do whatever they are offered. So I don't think that is something that's empowering women, because in the other, like, it's in fact, I say, discrimination against women. So that's why this gender awareness should be bring to the floor, to the table, in some kind of different way. That's what I believe.
Okay, well, thank you for that.
Just one question, yeah, that culturally I understand the thing, because it always happened the same, but actually I had the same thing with the UNDP people talking about local economic development. They are very aggressive about how the way we have to put in economy in the local places, but nobody's saying anything about, but I feel in the same way, so we're sharing feelings, and then I share, but the interesting thing is that always happened with feminists, and always with the gender-aware thing, that everybody's concerned, like, oh, yeah, people, you know, women are very aggressive. Maybe some, because we are not equal and not in the same way, the way that we speak. And maybe some women were very, I don't know, with different behavior, or maybe that people don't like, but I think that having power is not bad, and having strong ideas is not bad. And also happened to me with people from UNDP, actually.
Thank you. I think our interpretation of what feminist or feminism is has to do sometimes with the history of feminism in and of itself, and how we interpret it according to which generation we're from. So, for instance, I'm part of the women's movement in Jamaica, and I get teased because they call me, I'm the cuspy, I'm on the cusp of the previous generation and the one that's, you know, directly behind me. Sometimes we do have hierarchies, or I guess you could say tensions in leadership among the women's movement in the Caribbean, because the earlier generation, I guess we could say, or the mothers of feminism in the Caribbean, we would tease them and say, you know, you're very aggressive, you man bash, you don't like men. So we, for my generation, there is a brand of feminism that actually does not like men. And we have come to that conclusion. And I think there is an element of it, but at the same time, there's a way in which, in order for my generation to advance in the gender movement and to do gender work, the women who were doing gender work before with such a strong feminist stance paved that way. Because I think you had to, because feminism addresses the historical disadvantage of women and social and economic levels, or whatever level you want to look at it, it is a deconstruction that is also deeply political. So you are advocating, you are deconstructing, you are transforming, you are taking a revolutionary step. And because you choose to do that in a way that upsets a hierarchy, that deconstructs a society, you are going to get antagonism. So I think if we accept that is what they did, I don't think that it is fair for us to then say it's a bad word, because it is historically loaded and it comes with a certain kind of responsibility and leadership. So I think we have to give them kudos for doing that, so that it now becomes a lot easier for us, for somebody like myself, to do, and rather than call it feminism, I just say it's gender work. So I think we have to look at it from that angle as well. And I still don't call myself a feminist, but I work with feminists.
I think I would agree with what you just said. Maybe one way to think about it is whether in economics or in everyday life, if we treat whatever is orthodox to be something that is the dominant paradigm, and then to consider whatever is heterodox as something that is challenging that dominant paradigm. So if the dominant paradigm, the orthodox paradigm, if you will, is a male-dominated society, then the feminism being a heterodox, let's say, idea would be something that challenges that. And to kind of go back to Khurshid's point, perhaps feminism is viewed as a movement that is inherently disrespectful of men or challenging men in some ways. And I think that's maybe the, I'm not sure, I mean, not to put any words in your mind, but perhaps that's one way, that's perhaps why it is so, you said, of offensive, I think, or insulting, what's the word, offensive. So perhaps, again, something that is orthodox and we're trying to challenge that. But then there was another point that Khurshid made, which I think is important, which is whether we are talking about differences among men and women or poor or rich, really we are talking, and that goes also back to what Rania mentioned, are we talking about feminism or are we talking about humanism, and what are the differences? Because we are really talking about giving access to people, giving opportunities to people, no matter how these people are differentiated, whether it's by gender, age, race, or anything else. So I think that's something else I would like to really talk a little bit more about. What is the difference?
Something occurred to me while you were speaking, Tamar, and I think the critical thing which makes a feminist so different from others is that, or feminism, is that they are concerned with the construction of patriarchy and how unequal it is in the relations between men and women. And women who are concerned with feminism from that standpoint will upset men. Men, in a sense, patriarchy is implicit. It's a kind of power that is subscribed. It is a kind of power that sometimes is so invisible that they themselves, from my experience with working in men who do, I would say they do gender work, but they're not willing to even touch patriarchy. Because once you get into the relations of patriarchy, you are going to ask them to deconstruct themselves, deconstruct the use of their own power, and as much gender work you can do. Once you get into that realm, then you're going to upset the apple cart, and not everybody wants the apple cart to be upset.
Just one more point, though. So, and then I'll be done. So then the question is then, are we then talking about feminism as a subset of humanism, as just one dimension, one angle, or is it something? Or do they simply overlap? And are there some aspects within feminism which are different from humanism?
Maybe we'll have our lunch in the room.
And I think it's very... I think it's very interesting point you're saying, but I think one of the perversions of the orthodox and all of the and the patriarchalism is to see the world in a binarial way. You know, like woman, men, man, woman, man. You know, black, white. You know, feminism or humanism. No, and I think that we're talking about in the same, that the humanist maybe would be the paradigm that, no, that everybody, I don't know, wants, even the people from the left wing, you know? Why nobody, you know, is the same. Maybe they are not going to be always in the left wing, and that what the aim is to be in a humanism, you know? And then... No, this is my opinion. Maybe I'm absolutely wrong, no?
We are trying to dismantle all the discrepancies against women in the society and in India and part of other oppressed people. But, you know, some people, and those are the men who are enjoying the privileges and comforts of this world, and so whatever we say, either in aggressive forms or in softer, milder tones, will be threatening and offensive for them, because they will not voluntarily give up the privileges they enjoy, because it's very comforting for them, this all system. So I don't believe in saying things either in softer or aggressive form, because it will be in whatever form will be threatening for them. I mean, because power will not be given up voluntarily.
Well, I'm not trying to define what feminism or feminist is, but I just want to tell you that the way I approach those issues, just I take it personally. I think a lot about my mom. What could have changed that, you know, that could make my mom's life, you know, better? If I had the power to change things, what could it be? So that's how I see it. So as an economist, I try to see the economic systems and incentive systems and other things. But yep.
Very nice. And this refers to a very profound methodological point, that knowledge is experiential and relational, right? Because he's thinking about his knowledge in terms of his experience and his mother's experience and his relationship to her. So he's not seeing himself as an isolated, you know, prototype male who has to lose privileges and so on and so forth. So that's a very wonderful thing, way to think. Rania, did you have an intervention?
Yes. No. I just wanted to say that just to support what people are saying, that even today I am seeing, for example, in Africa, not only traditionally, you know, the whole patriarchy, but more as we are going towards modernity, towards new technology, etc. I see men being open to anything new, but to your human's power, and actually they're even borrowing from other cultures to keep women more under their power. One example, in my country, first of all, in my language, you don't say women and men. No, you say people. You call people human beings. So the notion of men and women is something that is very limited. You call people human beings. Also, when you marry, you never take your husband's name. You keep your own name, and because when you are being greeted from, like people tell me, when they meet me, what is your name? I say Fal. And they say, Fal, how are you? Fal, how is your family? How is your health? But when that now, women marry, and men demand that women take their name. But it's not constitutionally recognized, but everybody say, well, I am Mrs. So-and-so. And I say, but why do you take your husband's name? Because this is not traditional. But, my husband may be offended if I don't take your name. And actually, I have somebody came to my house one day looking for me. And my mother was there, and she said, I'm looking for Yasin C, because my husband's name is C. My mother said, no, she didn't live here. And when I came home, my mother told me, well, there's in the street somebody named Yasin, but she has the same last name than Habib. But she lives on the street. Isn't it funny? And I said, Mom, they're looking for me. She said, how come they're looking for you? What do you mean? I say, well, you know, women in Senegal sometimes take their husband. And she was extremely shocked by that, because she never knew about that. So just to tell you that how even progressively we are losing the space of that we had in terms of your identity is your family, it's your own name, and you never lose your identity because you are married. But everybody laugh. When I've been married for 30 plus years and I keep my name. People laugh about that. Oh, Yasin, you're such a feminist. You know. So.
So then we have Rania.
I think you have to.
I want to mention two things. One, that the same way that I believe it is productive to get away from generalizations about women, it is equally important to get away from generalizations about men. It is not all men. It is not everywhere. I have colleagues, and some of them are sitting on the table. Some of them have just arrived, that they would not shy away from saying, actually, that in my area, my field of work, is gender and economics, is feminist economics. They will not. So something, if that is possible in one human being, that is possible. That is possible. So depending on the position that men themselves occupy and what associations they have with words, and words can kill, and words can motivate, words can bring a revolution, we, of course, have to nuance all of this. We cannot just, you know, let it aside. So this discussion that I missed most of, unfortunately, one person had fallen a little bit sick, so I was with her, is extremely important. The second thing I wanted to say, continuing from Yassin, my friend Yassin here, is that reversals are possible in both directions. Unfortunately, I'm really disheartened to hear that, and I understand very well where you're coming from. But let me tell you what the case is in Greece. After the first election of the socialist government, the Papandreou government, now the law is, I got married in Greece. I was 41 when I got married. To the surprise of my entire family. They thought I'd remain single for the rest of my life, and they had very good reason to believe that. So, okay, so I got married, and then I discovered that if I wanted to change my name, which I did not, I would have to petition the government. So it is not that automatically when you get married, you get the name of your husband. Actually, the norm is that you maintain your name, and that if you want to change it, you have to petition, and you will. It is not that you have to go to court. It's a simple piece of paper that you file to the authorities, but it is not automatic. And that was done by the same government that said unpaid family workers, that in Greece were 90% women, will have a pension for life, independent of their husbands. So the political space does not exist today, but it does not mean that it will not exist tomorrow and that we cannot enter. So whether it is at this level or whether it is in terms of transforming financial institutions and all kinds of processes that are embedded in promoting equality of human beings, including of women, can happen. With reversals, but it can happen. Thank you.
Naming of things, but I wanted to move and say a lot of times people use the word gender as a code word for feminist, and I just am going to actually explain what feminist means to me later as distinct from gender, the use of the word gender, and the way I refer to myself is as a feminist economist, but I'm a very eclectic economist, so in many ways I'm a post-Keynesian. I would be considered Marxist, and I would be considered, and I also consider myself an institutionalist and a feminist. So it's a very eclectic kind of place that I'm coming from, but by using the word feminist, I want to specify, at least for myself, because these words can mean different things to people, it's important to explain what they mean to us personally so that we can have a conversation where we don't talk across, you know, to each other. But for me, I use the word feminist economics as distinct from gender aware, but many places I have also used the word gender aware. Economics as well, because feminist entails more than gender awareness. When I'm talking about feminism, I am talking about all forms of social differentiation. I'm talking about not only gender, but I'm also talking about class, ethnicity, the religious kinds of divide, caste, if we are talking about country where there is caste, and I always talking about the what I call the imperial divide of the people who come, who live in rich countries versus the people who live in not so, at least monetarily not so rich countries, okay? So I am talking about a combination, an overlapping combination of social relations of power. And that's why I tend to use the word feminist economics as distinct from just gender aware. Because sometimes when we say gender aware, people might think we don't care about class relations, we don't care about caste, ethnicity, you know, religion, race, but we are talking about, I'm talking about all kinds of overlapping power relations in society and in the economy when I use the word feminist. Okay, so whatever it is that leads, that is a signifier of a power relation. Okay, it is not only your gender, your sex, or preference for your sexuality, and so on, but I'm talking about a combination of overlapping combination of power relations. So that's why I use the word feminist. But other people may use the word humanist, and I'm very happy with that. As long as we clarify our words, what they mean to each other, and we don't talk across each other, that is fine. When people choose to call themselves humanist economists, that is fine. Or if people want to use the word gender aware, but say at the same time, I am also aware of class, ethnicity, sexuality, and so on, this is fine with me. I don't have any problem. But I just want to make sure that we are all clear on that distinction. But I do understand, and of course very much appreciate, that the word feminism, the F word, is a very loaded word. So, and it may even depend on the context, whether you choose to use this word or gender aware, or gender. Okay? Now, I want to now move to the next slide. Neoclassical versus heterodox economics, and here heterodoxy has a bunch of paradigms in it, and I am just going to sort of read, but alternative paradigms, what alternative paradigms are. A paradigm can be described as the set of rules and methods accepted by a scientific community. So then the question is always, of course, who gets to be in the scientific community and who gets to be out of it? Who gets included, who gets excluded? Scientific knowledge is for the most part the result of normal science, that is the work of scientists within the confines of their paradigm. However, normal scientists are sometimes confronted with critical anomalies that put in doubt the validity of the whole paradigm. An accumulation of anomalies leads eventually to a paradigmic crisis and to the emergence of new paradigms. Okay, and those of you who may have read Thomas Kuhn may be familiar with what we just talked about. But at this moment, we have been for a long time living in a state of paradigmic crisis. Why? Because we have been told, coming from this perspective of orthodoxy, and also, of course, remembering what Jan was talking about yesterday and so on, that we have been told for a very long time by very powerful institutions that if countries do X, Y, Z, and so on and so forth, and understand the notion that markets know best, then they will reach sort of nirvana, as it were, right? That's what we have been told. But actually what we see is that there is a complete kind of dissonance between reality and what this theory says. The theory says one thing, but this is completely out of touch and unable to explain the reality of economic relations and economic phenomena. So for a long time, neoclassical economists and orthodox economists have chosen to do the following. They have sort of tweaked the reading and interpretations of reality. They resist changing the theory, so instead of trying to rethink the theory, they try to sort of read what is going on in ways that will make reality consistent with theory. But it is the theory that is problematic and therefore cannot give you proper readings and useful readings of what is going on. So this is, so we are in a kind of a situation of paradigmic crisis. And therefore it's an important moment for us to really make the utmost whatever interventions we can in theoretical terms and in practical terms. Because this is a moment, this is an important moment of paradigmic crisis. Now, when we look at neoclassical economics versus heterodox economics, on this side I have, there are some antagonizing pairs that I have put down. On this side are sort of the kinds of things that correspond to neoclassical economics, and on this side is what corresponds to heterodox economics. So neoclassical economics, Rania mentioned, is ahistorical. Homo economics behaves the same way everywhere in agriculture and was beginning, it was actually behaving that way. Even when, and on the seventh day God created the world, God also apparently created Homo economicus on the seventh day, and this guy has been behaving the same way. That's the neoclassical notion of history. You know, once God does say on the seventh day, then nothing changed. All right, so ahistorical. I am not trying to be facetious about the Bible. The book of Genesis is one of my favorite text to read. I read this, I have read this text many, many times. It's a very interesting, very revealing text, by the way. But I will not get in, you know, I will not get into, you know, textual analysis of the Bible, but I didn't mean to sound facetious when I refer to the, you know, on the seventh day. So ahistorical versus historical. Historically situated analysis. That is common with all heterodox economists, and of course, and now I'm going to use the word feminist economics, but you can substitute your, if you prefer, humanist or gender aware, as long as we understand that we're talking about the same thing, that's fine. So I'm going to use the word feminist now. All other heterodox traditions, including the feminist economics tradition, is historically situated analysis. You cannot do anything outside of history. No analysis. Neoclassical economics, substantial versus procedural rationality. We talked about this rationality of Homo economicus, who is constructed as a person who doesn't have any connectivity to anybody else, right? Because he's absolutely selfish. He's only thinking about his own self-interest. You would not want to have this guy as your neighbor, heaven forbid. At 2 a.m, if you needed to go to the hospital, you cannot knock on the door of this Homo economicus and say, can you help me? Because he doesn't care, right? So that disconnected individual who has no empathy by construction, has no empathy, cannot feel what other feels can be feeling. For example, cannot feel the sufferings of a person who is poor. Why? Because he's somebody who maximizes his own utility, and by definition, utility is something that is subjective in neoclassical economics, right? So this person is constructed as someone who has no empathy, no understanding, or has desire or capacity to understand other human beings. Someone without any empathy, without any connectivity. This is a person who is not socially embedded in anything, right? So, and therefore can be rational in the sense of being able to know his own preferences, these so-called preferences, and then order them and then maximize utility. And that's what is called as a substantial versus procedural rationality. Now, when we oppose this notion of rationality, it doesn't mean that we're saying that people are irrational. We're not saying that at all as heterodox people. We are not saying, oh, people are crazy, the world is crazy, so, you know, let's all go jump off a bridge. No, we're not saying people are irrational. We are just saying the notion of rationality is not approximated by this Homo economicus. And this, we would say, corresponds to what we call in neoclassical economics, what we call methodological individualism. The analysis starts with the construction of this individualism, individual, and the methodology always surrounds this individual. And when you are sort of looking at the economy as a whole, the economy as a whole is actually some of these individuals, right? But the methodology, the building block of the whole notion, concepts of economics, start with this individual. This particular individual is the unit of analysis, as is the most important category of analysis. Is the unit of analysis and the category of analysis. And in neoclassical economics, there is something called the micro foundations of macroeconomic analysis. In fact, if you don't sort of put your macroeconomics grounded in these microeconomic foundations and link it to this sort of optimized behavior of the, you know, the individual, the firm, et cetera, then your macroeconomics is kind of what? False. It's not really up to par. It's not really scientific. It's not scientific, right? It's not scientific from a neoclassical point of view. But actually, when we are looking at this perspective from the, and I don't have this on the board, but just because I talked about this microeconomic foundations of macroeconomics, in the other traditions of heterodoxy, you know, where you were talking about institutionalism or post-Keynesianism, et cetera, Marxism and feminism, feminist economics, we would be more correctly talking about the macroeconomic foundations of microeconomic behavior. It's the other way around. Because persons find themselves in a particular environment that we can call the macroeconomy, right? The sum total of these economic relations. And really how they behave is going to depend on this context that they are in. So it is more useful to talk about the macroeconomic foundations of microeconomic behavior or the behavior of individuals than the other way around. So heterodox people do not accept this notion of microeconomic foundations of the macroeconomy, which is then linked to this kind of methodological individualism. Because heterodox people think about in ways that are holistic and organic and think about the relationships between people, okay? So in that sense, we can go to back to a very sort of basic and primary philosophical point. Of course, that was made by Hegel, which is what? The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And the whole is sometimes less than, sometimes more than the sum of the parts, but it is surely never equal to the sum of the parts. And this is, and I have to say, again, refer to Paul Streeton, who is one of my favorite economists, and he was commenting about the World Bank and the IMF, and he said, you know, and this was in a public thing, so I can repeat this. He said, you know, there are so many people who are so talented individually. When you look at these individuals, they're really sensible people. They are very talented, smart, and so on and so forth. But it is really a case of the whole being less than the sum of the parts in these institutions. But the point is that the whole is always greater than the sum of the parts. So we have to think about the economy as an organic thing and as a holistic thing. The next point is that instrumentalism versus realism. We don't make assumptions in heterodox traditions just so that we can build nice kind of models. Of course, in positivist methodology, the realism of your assumptions do not absolutely, they make no difference whatsoever, right? You can make the silliest assumptions in the world. You can say that, you know, I'm a bunny, and so on and so forth, and then you can build a whole model on the basis of this assumption that I'm a bunny, etc. And then if this empirical verification turns out to be, you know, consistent with what you're observing, this is just great. So you can build a theory and model on the basis of, you know, so-and-so is a bunny, and it doesn't matter whether the assumptions of realism or not, realistic or not. But in heterodox traditions, we start with observations that we believe capture reality. I don't want to say that there is only one type of reality, but we can have a contestation about that. At least we get to contest whether some assumption is realistic or not, and we should contest the realism of the assumptions, right? We don't say, oh, it doesn't matter what the assumption is. So in that case, you know, you make assumptions that are of a garbage quality, and then, of course, what you generally get out in a model is garbage in, garbage out. But it is very important to have assumptions that are realistic, and in fact, that's one of the things that we do. For example, when we're building models and so on, we try to talk about what are called stylized facts, and we're going to talk about this in building models and so on. We talk about stylized facts, try to see if there are regularities that we observe and so on, and we capture those and make those the assumptions of models when we are doing modeling exercises. And of course, this method of neoclassical economics, it's all about allocation of scarce resources among competing ends. That's the definition of who? Lionel Robbins. And of course, non-heterodox traditions focus on accumulation, not on scarcity, but on accumulation. And of course, if we also look at classical political economy, again, going back to Adam Smith, going back to Ricardo, Marx, and so on, the subject of analysis, economic analysis, is the relationship between value, distribution, and accumulation, or growth, right? Those are the things that constitute the central part of the analysis. Whereas in neoclassical economics, accumulation is a growth is a kind of an afterthought. It is an afterthought because the analysis is really about taking these individuals who have these given endowments, right? Who start with these given, mysteriously given endowments, right? They have these endowments, we don't know where they come from, the heavenly skies. And they have these preferences that also come from the heavenly skies. And they have this behavior of maximizing utility. And boom, the analysis is exchange-centric. It is not accumulation-centric. It is not really principally about creation of value or accumulation. It is about exchange and maximization of utility. So it's about allocation. It is really not about production in the first approximation, or neither is it about reproduction, something that we will come back to. Okay, we have 15 minutes. We have 15 minutes, or what do we have? Total. Okay, we have two total of 15 minutes. Okay, we have 15 more slides, so we're going to race a little bit, race to the slides. Okay. Okay, pluralism and objectivity. Pluralism, gender-aware economics views are reminiscent and are part of ideas which have been long advocated by heterodox economists. That's a statement that I made before. So this is Julie Nelson, who says that feminist analysis suggests that there should not be just one economic model, but rather many economic models, depending on the usefulness of various modeling techniques in the various applications. So generally, pluralism is something that is welcome and embraced. But personally, I embrace pluralism, but I do not say anything goes. I would advocate the right of everyone to speak coming from different perspectives, but I also have the right to contest. In other words, just because somebody is has a right to speak and so on and so forth, doesn't mean that we don't contest them. This is the whole point of knowledge creation, is that knowledge creation takes place by contestation. But everybody must be included in the process of contestation. Everybody must have the license to be able to contest. They cannot be excluded on the basis that they are women and whatever they are. But that doesn't also mean that sort of anything goes, right? That we actually have, all of us have beliefs that we uphold, and we should be able to contest them and have a discourse of contestation. Contestation is not something that is necessarily hostile, antagonistic, or antagonistic. For contestation to take place, actually, we must all acknowledge, prior to contestation of knowledge, we must all acknowledge that we all have a legitimate seat around the table, that we respect each other, and we have feelings of empathy and compassion for each other. And we may even say we love each other, when we don't have to maybe, you know, be so like this, but we would also say we have compassion and we recognize the humanity of the other, that when we are contesting something that somebody says, we are not doing this from a position of trying to show how really, really smart we are than everybody else. If that's the spirit of contestation, that is not really contestation for the purpose of creating knowledge and science, okay? That is a plain power trip. That's a power trip, okay? And in fact, as feminist economists, we are oppose hierarchical positionings, and we oppose these kinds of improper exercising of power, right? We must accept that we all have a seat at the table and we are all equal, we are anti-hierarchical. Everybody has the freedom to speak and speak their minds honestly. And that when I speak my mind honestly, and tell Khurshid, for example, that he is absolutely there. Now, Khurshid, I am not telling Khurshid he's wrong. I'm just, you know, just because, you know, as I said, Jan was sort of always referring to Khurshid in his example. But if I tell you, you are dead wrong, Khurshid, that should not be interpreted as what? Well, it is criticism, but criticism should not be interpreted as me also implying that you are not really worthy as a human being, or that I don't respect you. No, I have to make it clear that I do respect him. In fact, telling him that I disagree with him would mean that at the really bottom of it, I am really disrespectful of him, because otherwise I'd be patronizing him. I'd be saying, well, he's a younger person, so let me go easy on. No, that would be patronizing or metronizing in my case. No, if we want to have conversations, the conversations have to be honest. And we should be really able to disagree with each other, while at the same time making clear that we are absolutely respectful of each other. You see? And that is the difference between pulling a power trip on someone, which is the very thing that we are trying to oppose, because we know knowledge creation processes entail also power relations. So what we are doing here as GEM, insofar as we are engaging in the process of knowledge creation and sharing and so on, sharing of knowledge, is we are trying to go as much as we can against the grain. Yeah? Okay. Okay. Objectivity. So in that sense, there is a notion of objectivity, and there are two notions of objectivity. I didn't go into detail in this, but objectivity of the scientist, an economic scientist, is not coming from this perspective, is not sort of the individual attributes of the person creating knowledge, right? Now, let me switch to another victim, Tamar. For example, Tamar, when she's doing econometric work, as someone who's, you know, has integrity and moral and so on and so forth, what will she do? You know, she will have her data sources, she will document where she will do the best she can to make sure, you know, there are no mistakes and so on and so forth, and then she will do her econometric things and then report them honestly, right? Okay. That kind of objectivity is... And scientific honesty is that is an attribute of the individual, does not make the process, the total social correct process of producing knowledge, objective. This is what we would call weak objectivity, to the extent that individual scientists sort of follow rules of ethics and morality and so on and so forth. That would be just weak objectivity. But what we really mean by objectivity in the process of production of knowledge is the social process through which persons of different ideas and backgrounds can participate and can engage in contestation. That is to say, objectivity of the process of knowledge production is not an attribute of an individual scientist. It is an attribute of the whole process of knowledge production. right? So to the extent that there are consistently groups of persons who are left out, excluded from producing knowledge and giving authority to this process of knowledge production, that knowledge is not objective and that knowledge is actually biased. Because it will systematically exclude the experiences of certain groups of people. So in the case that when we are talking about feminists, we are talking about exclusion of a discussion of experiences of especially women. So is it any wonder why economic traditions have not paid very much attention to unpaid work? If we could have had a mother of economics who would have the same status of Adam Smith and Ricardo and da-da-da-da-da, all of these people, then perhaps economics would have been constructed very differently. Because it is women's lives who have been, it is in women's lives where the work of unpaid work and reproduction, work of reproduction, has been much more central to women's lives than to men's lives. This doesn't mean that men don't do anything, it's just that they do different kinds of things. There's a gender-based division of labor in all societies that we can see, right? So women's, it is not only that women who are excluded from the process of construction, producing economic knowledge, but that means that they're also their experiences have not been taken to heart, right? This is the important. I mean, it is not like sort of the way that people sometimes think about it. It's politically correct to have one from, you know, one person man, one person woman, and then one, you know, from this country, one from that continent, and so on. It sort of boiled down to this sort of superficial political correct. But these are never about political correctness. These are about, these kinds of representations are really about the objectivity of the process itself, and they're about inclusion and exclusion in the processes of knowledge production. So is it clear? And there's a wonderful article by Sandra Harding, 1995, Feminist Economics, and this should be on our, posted on our website, and I would refer to you to that if you'd like to read. She's a philosopher. So feminist economics, again, is holistic, interdisciplinary, inclusive, and views the process of production of knowledge just as important as the content, the specific content of the knowledge. In fact, those two things are inseparable. The process is not separable from the content and vice versa. The content of the knowledge is not separable from the process of production of knowledge. Is it? Yes, okay. Anybody have any comments, questions? So feminist economics, anti-hierarchical, contests existing power relations and structures, takes institutions and history as fundamental elements of the analysis, right? We have to know what institutions and history we are talking about in order to contextualize the analysis. So culture, history, politics, institutions shape and inform the analysis. So in these ways, feminist economists are similar to other economists, other heterodox economists. So then the question is, why do we have another thing? Because here I say, heterodox, just like in other heterodox traditions, feminist economics is about value, distribution, and growth, or accumulation. So it is about production and reproduction. It is not a static thing. But feminist economics, more than any other heterodox tradition, also views reproduction, not only production of things and commodities, but reproduction of human beings, and in fact, reproduction of social relations and human beings, and reproduction of labor power, the thing that we go and sell in the market if we don't have, if we own nothing, no other means of production. This notion of reproduction is actually central to the analysis of provisioning of needs. So we don't talk about preferences. We talk about needs. Needs are socially constructed, right? Needs are socially created. Preferences carry the notion that they came from the heavenly sky. Again, we don't talk about endowments. You know, why is it that I have a zero endowment of this, you know, piece of building? I don't have in my endowment, this building doesn't, and it's in somebody else's. Where did that come from? No, there is no such thing as endowments. What there is that there is a social reproduction of class relations, which entail within them a reproduction of property relations, right? And these are the things that define your relationship to property. Right? Class relations, but also gender relations actually define your relationship to property and to the lack of property and to the actual control or the lack of control of property. Because there's a difference between owning property, ownership of property, and usually in Marxian economics, for example, class relations are defined on the basis of people's relationship to property. That's how classes are defined. But in feminist economics, we say it is also gender that comes and determines your relationship to property. It is not only class relations. And it's a much more complicated interface of those things. And we say further that you may have formal ownership of property, but you actually, power relations are such that, with the interface between class and power relations are such that, as a woman, you may have formal ownership of property, but you may not have substantive exercise and control over the property or over the means of production. So property relations and the interaction between class and gender relations, they become much more complicated and complex when you are looking at the economy through a feminist lens, where your analytical, your primary analytical categories is gender alongside class, alongside, you know, ethnicity, what I call the imperial divide and so on. Okay? So, to sum it up, if you're a neoclassical person, the primary category of analysis you have is the individual, neoclassical. The primary unit of analysis is your primary category is the individual. If you are a classical political economist, actually, if you are Adam Smith and Ricardo and Marx, they all had class analysis. Marx, Ricardo, Smith, they all started with the great landed classes of society. There are, you know, really Ricardo, you know. There are three great classes in society, you know, the landlord. So they all start with specification of the class relations that they are talking about. So in that sense, they are also very historically grounded, and they are starting with the class relations. But of course, it is Marx who takes the class relations to their, fullest elaboration, if you will. And in Marxian economics, so class becomes the primary unit of analysis, the primary analytical category. Well, in feminist economics, it is class and gender. And gender doesn't have a lesser status than class. And neither does class. Okay, this is the way I interpret feminist economics, though. This is not going to be every other feminist economist. You have to just ask people, what do you mean? Because this is not going to be how everybody is going to interpret feminist economics is, but I'm just saying this is going to be my interpretation, and I would also submit that interpretation of many of the colleagues who are sitting around the table who are in GEM. Now, So in that sense, it is class and gender and all kinds of other dividing categories that represent social power relations are there. Reproduction is central and very important in ways that it is not central and important to other paradigms. Okay? And again, in other paradigms, in Marxian economics, there might be acknowledging, yes, women and men are different, blah, 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 But there are versions of Marxism which will say, well, after we have the revolution, there is the primary contradiction, is the class contradiction, and then after we get rid of that, we're going to also get rid of the contradiction between men and women, because one is seen as being dependent on each other. Well, when you're coming from a feminist kind of background, you don't see one contradiction as primary to the other. In fact, as a matter of fact, if you look at history, you will see that the emergence of patriarchy is rather, in historical terms, is rather prior to the full emergence of power relations, notwithstanding, of course, Engels, although I consider the work of Engels on this absolutely revolutionary and important, given the time in which he was writing, absolutely brilliant, the origin of the family, private property, and the state. Everybody should read that if they haven't. But I will move to the next point. Feminists, of course, do not claim to be value-free, neither do other heterodox economists. In fact, as feminist economists, we make our values and ethics explicit. This is in contradiction to neoclassical economics, right? There is a difference between positive and normative side. And these two things doesn't look like they have anything to do with each other. Because in neoclassical economics, being scientific means doing this positive economics, right? And then you separate the positive from the normative. So this is the most disastrous distinction in history of economics. And as whether we are Marxists or whatever we are, but especially and particularly as feminist economists, we say these are our ethical positions. This is our moral values. This is what we are trying to achieve, right? We make it explicit that whatever we are analyzing is not separable from our moral selves. Now, actually, in neoclassical economics too, it is not that people don't have a particular moral position. Is it? Can you actually really separate your ethical position and moral list from being this, doing the scientific? Can you? And why not? Perché, madame? Can you explain this to us?
I think that it's not possible because we don't express ourselves, or nothing that we do is separated from who we are, our cultural background, our class background, our ethnic background, our geographical location, so in our socialization, so in whatever it is that we're writing, it is going to influence us in some form, whether it's implicit or whether it's explicit. So I don't find that it's value-free either.
Nothing is really value-free in this life. What you choose to see, what you don't choose to see is a reflection of your values. So if you see the person who's starving on the street, this is a reflection of your values. If you don't, this is a reflection of values. Construction of homo economicus is a reflection of your values. So neoclassical economists also have values. It is just that they don't like to, or they are taught, I wouldn't say even that many of them are not even conscious of this, the blinders make them think that they don't have any values, right? So they actually have values, and sometimes, of course, we can get into a discussion of ideology, which I will not do that right now, but we can think of this also in terms of the notion of ideology. Okay, feminist economists make their values and ethics explicit. They value human beings and human life, and so they talk about well-being, not utility. Well-being of human beings. Like other heterodox traditions, feminists emphasize power relations. In Marxian analysis, classical Marxian analysis, the emphasis is on class, just what I was saying before. In neoclassical economics, the individual is central. We have been talking about that. And in feminist economics, gender is central alongside these other categories. And they are stratifiers which play a role in determining who owns what, who does actually what kind of work in the economy in terms of production and reproduction, and at the end, who gets what in terms of distribution, right? Who owns what, who actually does what kind of work, and who gets what? Distribution, reproduction, production. These are all determined jointly by gender, class, race, ethnicity, religion, imperial divide, and so on. There is no such thing as an endowment. Feminist economists are very often hyphenated people. They are eclectic. They draw from many traditions. And this notion of feminist versus gender aware is something actually we discussed in the beginning. And feminists are kind of suicidal. And what I mean by that is that they want to change the world. Okay, why is that so? Because if you want to make the world a humane place, an equitable, just, and dignified place for everyone, not only for women, but for men, women, children, everyone, if you have really brought about a just world order, then is there a need for feminist economics? No, there will be no raison d'etre. There will be no reason to have feminist economics. So when I say they are suicidal, I'm talking about, you know, intellectual. You know, if you accomplish your mission, there won't be such a thing as feminist economics. It is itself a historically contingent thing, right? And this is also like, kind of like Marxism. If you really take Marxism to its really philosophical core, there won't be such a thing as a need for Marxism. In fact, of course, Marx would never call himself Marxism, but there won't be a need for something called Marxism. If Marxists can bring about their the realization of their dreams, there won't be any reason, because it will be a just and fair. So in that sense, feminists are like Marxists, and I am calling them both of these kinds of people suicidal in the sense of intellectual suicide. And so the thoughts they promote are historically contingent as well. Their own process of knowledge production is historically contingent, as is everything else. Now, as you know, Marx had something called the 11th thesis. He had written something called Thesis of Feuerbach. The 11th of these theses says philosophers, up to now, philosophers have contemplated the world, but the point is to change it. The point is to change it. And I think all feminists are also 11th thesis people at heart as well. And they believe that knowledge is itself power. So producing knowledge is part of the process of changing the world. Okay? And that equity and justice are possible. These are possible. And some of the implications of what you do when you're producing feminist economic knowledge from the perspective of value theory, for example, and I will take another 5 minutes. I'm really sorry. Is that okay? Is everybody okay? Take another 5 minutes and then we'll call it. Okay. From the perspective of value theory, of course, we have many different kinds of value theory. The neoclassical one is a subjective theory of value, right? Value is determined, there's nothing different from the price. It's a supply, demand, boom, value. And if there is no positive demand for something, what are you going to do? It has zero. Ta-da, it has no value. Okay. Subjective theory of value. If we look at the classical political economists, Adam Smith, Ricardo, blah, 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 Marx, we have what kind of theory of value? We have the labor theory of value. It is labor that confers upon something the value comes from. It is an intrinsic theory of value, not an extrinsic, but what I didn't say, intrinsic one. Anyway, okay. Now, in the neoclassical system, you know, everybody has their little endowments, and then everybody has their little preferences, and then we all go about exchange things, and then here we come a very harmonious system. And the point of neoclassical economics is always that one should not intervene in that process, right? Markets know best, and markets are going to give us the prices, which is also the theory of value. Well, guess what? One of the things that gender does, alongside these other stratifies, is that gender is one of the things that determines systematically not only what people are going to do, but also it determines distribution, what people are going to get in return for what they produce in the production system. I'm not even talking about the production system, right? And we know, one of the things we know, that systematically all over the world, every place, every country, and so on and so forth, you control for productivity of men and women, and boom, you have this little differential that says you control for all the, you know, education, this, that, and the other thing. And what do you find? Women are always systematically paid less compared to men. This cannot be explained by productivity, education, experience, da 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 da. So, if this is systematic, and if this is systemic, what are the prices that we observe? The prices that we observe are always discrimination prices and distorted quote unquote. And if something is so systemic and systematic, it is an inherent part of the way the system works. It is not just an anomaly that, you know, some women in whatever Pakistan get a little bit less and this and that and this. No, this is a part of the systemic, this is a part of the system. So it is systemic. It is like talking about risk. You know, you can talk about risk as some individual taking risk here and there, and then you can talk about what is called systemic risk. No, this is systemic and systematic. Discrimination, differentiation is part of the way, the logic of the system itself. And it doesn't matter that, you know, the discrimination in this country, country X, China or whatever, is more than whatever country that we find. It doesn't matter. When we are importing goods that we call our Serafian basics, in the sense of Serafa, when we are importing them, we have actually brought this discrimination to the part of our system yesterday. That's why when Jan was talking about import prices yesterday, the manufactured prices, imports of manufactured goods from third world countries, they remain stable because we had a process through which women kept coming into the export markets and kept actually subduing the prices. So the fact that such manufactured goods prices were kept down and inflation was low was not due to inflation targeting. It was due to a lot of wage repression through this exploitation of particularly of women workers. We'll come back and visit that question. But what I am trying to say is that discrimination is not a little problem that you can solve and address on this side. You know, you get everybody to get a little bit more education, the women, make them literate, etc. No, this is a part of the system, the way the system works. And it's not only about women and men. It can be about different kinds of socially differentiated groups. So it is also about people living in the north versus people living in the south. And that's why we have something called the theory of unequal exchange. When we look at trade, we look at the theory of unequal exchange and theories of unequal exchange. Okay, I will move now. In terms of classical and Marxian political economy, the labor theory of value is the theory of value they have. The problem with this labor theory of value is that Marx, of course, said that the value of labor power is, he left this open. And he said this is historically and socially determined. He did not sort of very much probe the conditions under which the value of labor power is determined, right? But it is labor that confers value to everything else and creates value in Marxian economics. And the point, of course, is that the value of labor power or labor power is largely produced, reproduced where? It is the only commodity that is not produced on the circuit of capital. For those of you who are familiar with circuits of capital and Marxian economics, it is not produced within the circuit of capital. So, and you don't know the conditions of reproduction of labor power because it is reproduced largely by where? In the household. It is not a part of the circuit of capital. By whom? By women. By what kind of labor?
Unpaid labor. Okay, we're gonna wrap. We're wrapping now. So do we now sort of
What I'm trying to say is that this problem of unpaid work is not just we make this thing, you know, visible, we put some prices on it and make it visible. No, we have a theoretical catastrophe here, because this thing has been left out of the analysis. We have a theoretical catastrophe. We have had this theoretical catastrophe for a very long time, because the rate of accumulation or growth is related to, for those of you who are familiar with their maxim, if you're not, we'll talk about it another time as well. The rate of accumulation, the rate of growth, is linked to the, intimately to the value of labor power. In price terms, that's called the wage rate, right? But behind the wage rate is the value of labor power, which is produced by unpaid work and sometimes paid work, plus use of commodities, but it is produced and reproduced outside the circuit of capital. And Marxian analysis just kind of didn't really take a very close look at that. This is what feminists do and try to do, those of us who are coming from this kind of tradition of feminism. So if we really understand how accumulation and why accumulation takes place, why the growth rate is the way it is, we really have to. So this is central to understanding some of the central questions of the Marxian and classical political economy, questions of value, questions of distribution, questions of accumulation. So this is not just about tweaking the theories a little bit here, a little bit there, making it a little bit more friendly to women, you know, getting rid of this kind of discrimination. No, discrimination is a central and systemic part of the system, right? So you have to reconstruct the theory, and you have to also change reality. So it is all about the reproduction, ultimately reproduction of human beings by means of paid and unpaid work and by commodities, but outside the circuit of capital. It is about the relationship between the mode of production, as we would say in Marxian economics, the mode of production, right? Capitalism is a mode of production. But there are also always modes of reproduction. So one, and Marxian economics generally looks at the mode of reproduction, but doesn't pay so much attention to the mode of reproduction. So that's what we do when we do feminist economics. We look at the relationship between the mode of production and what we might call the mode of reproduction. I know, you have to go and reproduce yourselves, have some food. But last, but not least, let me practice my Spanish. Una otra mundo es posible. Yes? Sí? Yes. Adelante. Adelante, mujer. And gracias. So, another world is possible. We are, adelante, miss. You explain about adelante, but move. Move forward. So we are all going to move forward together, brothers and sisters. But thank you very much. Now we can all go and get some.